Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. And next up on This Week in Law, I'm joined by Matt Curtis and Peter Torin. We light a candle for internet laws. The Swiss have holes in their defamation protections in that liking something on Facebook might mean something different than you think it does. The internet is turning music upside down. Congress is doing the ostrich, and Uber wishes it could too. These and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 391, recorded June 23rd, 2017. Pie in the Sky. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Betterment, the largest independent online financial advisor. For one low transparent fee, Betterment gives you personalized advice and invests your money. For a limited time, you can get up to 6 months managed for free. Learn more at betterment.com/twill. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We're so thrilled that you've joined us this week. We have a bunch of really interesting topics to discuss, some very timely ones as well, and some great folks to do it with. We'd like to welcome back to the show Peter Torin. Peter, great to see you again.
Thank you for having me.
Peter, you haven't been on with us for a while. I went back into our archives and discovered that you've joined us twice before, back on episode 177 and episode 214. And way back then, we were discussing Apple versus Samsung and the Bradley Manning trial, both of which you would think had gone by the wayside. But no, those are both pretty current topics still. So glad to get you back. We're not going to go deeply into either of those areas today, but we are going to talk about a lot of what you are interested in and have been writing about. So I hope you're ready.
I am. Thank you.
Great. And for folks who did not tune in to episodes 177 and 214, let me introduce Peter to you and tell you a little bit more about him. He's an IP litigator and a former federal prosecutor with the Department of Justice's Computer Crimes and Intellectual Property section. So wonderful fit for our show here today and the topics we have to discuss. Also joining us is my co-host, Matt Curtis. Hello, Matt.
Hi, how's it going?
It's great. How are you?
Good, good. I missed the, we had a fire on the metro in DC today and I missed that. And so we got to be here for the show.
Wow. I'm really glad you missed the fire on the metro in DC. That's scary. Good that you weren't involved. All right. So we're going to jump right into some areas that involve intellectual property and computer crimes. And we're going to start out looking at a trade secrets case that is much in the news these days and is also moving into the realm of criminal prosecution as well. The big Uber news this week has been the resignation of CEO Travis Kalanick. If I'm saying his name right, I never quite get if he's Kalanick or Kalanick, but we'll go with however you guys want to say it today. Anyway, he has stepped down this week, and that has been all over the news and people speculating on what Uber's management is going to look like going forward, who will step in to the various top management roles they now have available. But another big wild card for Uber is what will happen with this intellectual property trade secrets theft case that has been going on by Waymo, which alleges that some of Uber's LiDAR technology actually was a trade secret that was brought to the company by an engineer who left Waymo and went to Uber. And his last name is Lewandowski. I'm blanking on his first name. But in any event, this has been a highly controversial issue in that trade secret case, which is still winding along. That trade secret case is one of the wild cards in what is going to happen to Uber as the company moves forward. So we wanted to look a little more closely at that case today, what's happening in it, and what you might expect to see happen in the future. And fortunately, we have Peter with us, who's been paying close attention to that case. Peter, I see you've been tapped a couple of times by Wired to weigh in on the case. Can you bring us up to speed as to where the Waymo case is right now and what interesting developments there have been?
Okay, I think it's certainly a very interesting case, and probably up to now, the most interesting aspect of it has been Judge Alsup's decision to make a criminal referral of the case to the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco. And while this is, I should say that for a federal judge to refer a case to a U.S. Attorney's Office for an investigation is relatively a rare occurrence, and Judge Alsup must believe that there is some serious misconduct on the part of Uber here that warrant an investigation. And that really portends very badly for Uber. And it's not clear who's under investigation. Certainly Mr. Lewandowski, Uber as a whole, should they have knowledge about his thing? But the fact that this has been referred to the U.S. Attorney's Office for investigation is a very serious matter. And theft of trade secrets is somewhat different from many other types of civil cases, because most type of civil cases do not have an analogous criminal component to them or criminal statutes to them. And theft of trade secrets do have that in the form of the Economic Espionage Act. And under the Economic Espionage Act, the government can investigate theft of trade secrets, and individuals who are found guilty of violating the Economic Espionage Act can be sentenced to quite lengthy prison terms. In fact, just recently, there was a case involving theft of trade secrets from DuPont, also in the Northern District of California. And the lead defendant in that particular case was sentenced to, I believe, approximately 180 or 190 months in jail, which you can work out the math, but is in excess of 15 years. So that really shows the kind of penalties that individuals are facing in companies with very large fines. So it's a very serious matter for Uber. If they're prevented from using any of this technology that may have already infected their system, it can cause a great deal of operating problems for Uber on a going forward basis.
Yeah, I imagine so. You have some special familiarity with the Espionage Act you were just mentioning. What's its full name again?
The full name of the act is the Economic Espionage Act of 1996. So it's been in effect for about 21 years. And there have been approximately about 180 or 190 prosecutions that the government has brought to date under the act. And as I said, there have been some very lengthy prison sentences that have been given to individuals who have been sentenced under the particular act. Most of this in general, the sentencing depends on the value of the trade secret misappropriated. So depending on the value of the Uber trade secrets, the Waymo trade secrets, and it may, if there are individuals involved in this, it may, or found guilty, they may be subject to a very long prison term.
Right. And you prosecuted one of the first of those cases, didn't you?
I did. I prosecuted a case back in 1996-97 against the Taiwanese company called Four Pillars that stole trade secrets from Avery Dennison involving adhesives. Avery Dennison is one of the largest adhesive manufacturers in the world for adhesives for just about anything, and they spend hundreds of millions of dollars a year on research and technology in developing new adhesives that work under a variety of conditions with heat, cold, things like that. That don't create stains. I mean, a whole bunch of criteria. And a Chinese company was involved in stealing the technology from a engineer at Avery Dennison, who actually shipped back the technology to Taiwan and went back there for a number of summers to give the engineers at Four Pillars lessons in how to learn the technology. And eventually Four Pillars was convicted, had to pay a $5 million fine. There was also about an $80 million civil damage award in favor of Avery Dennison, and the two of the top executives were also convicted of violating the Economic Espionage Act, but they had fled back to Taiwan, so they never served any time.
So I'm presuming that given this is a trade secret case involving Waymo's LIDAR technology, that Judge Alsup has seen items in the case or seen testimony or declarations in the case that are not a matter of public record that have influenced his decision to refer this to the U.S. attorney. Is that what you understand has happened here or what you presume has happened here?
Yeah, I think that's a very good presumption because in any trade secret case, the trade secret themselves and what is at issue is all going to be confidential and submitted to the court on a confidential basis, because obviously that's the heart of the case, is confidential information. So all this particular information that is a trade secret in this particular case all goes to the court under some form of confidentiality order. The public doesn't see it. The public may, in fact, never see the information, or may see the information eventually when there's a trial. But in general, it's treated very confidentially. So we don't really know the extent to which the amount of information, what information was taken, and the other details of the information that may be involved in this. So we're working based on assumptions and experience and things like that, and your belief that Judge Alsup has seen much more of the details and based his referral on that, I think, is a very accurate observation.
Okay, that's good to know that I'm able to guess about these things. My other question, based on the referral to the U.S. attorney, it seems to me like that might seem a little counterintuitive to the fact that Judge Alsup has also been telling the parties, Waymo in particular, well, you guys have had all kinds of opportunity for discovery and you don't seem to have found your smoking gun yet that ties the technology that Uber is using to the technology that was brought to the company by Lewandowski. Do you see any contradiction there?
Yeah, I think there is potentially a contradiction. I think Judge Alsup, and I've had the privilege of appearing in his courtroom, as an extremely able and one of the most intelligent judges probably in the United States, and really gets to the heart of the issues very quickly. He probably is pushing Waymo to put up and shut up and really be able to and really show and prove as to what exactly the technology that Uber may have stolen and what is at issue in the case, so that they're kind of quit waffling and quit taking the easy way out, perhaps. But at the same time, I think he probably thinks that there's enough there in terms of the actions of Lewandowski, perhaps, and Uber, maybe to cover up what they did, maybe other things. But again, this pure speculation. But certainly he thinks that there's enough there. There's enough smoke there. Maybe there's some fire there. Maybe the smoking gun isn't there. But there are, you know, the bullets and the pistols there, so to speak, to mix analogies. Enough there to refer the case. So it's somewhat of a contradiction, but it's not directly contradictory.
Right. And we were talking before the show, we don't know the answer to this question, it turns out, but in some of the coverage I've been reading about the case, today was called out as a big day in the case, a day when Waymo was supposed to be receiving a bunch of discovery that they had not yet received. So we may know more. Again, all the trade secret stuff tends to remain confidential in these kinds of cases. So I don't know that we may know more, but the parties may know more and the court may know more in the coming weeks based on what's being produced this week. Also this week, we had an interesting development yesterday where Uber's lawyers, this is reported in the Wall Street Journal, have gone ahead and stipulated or otherwise made the court aware that Travis Kalanick was that knew full well that when he hired Anthony Lewandowski that Anthony had those allegedly stolen files from Waymo in his possession, and that Kalanick told him not to bring the files to his new job. So this seems to be an interesting move on the chessboard in the case to go ahead now. I don't know if there's a correlation between the CEO having resigned this week and the lawyers deciding to take this step and say, oh yeah, he knew. But he made, took great pains to make sure that Uber's technology would not be tainted with the technology that the new engineer coming on was bringing to the company. What do you make of that, if anything, Peter?
Well, I think, I mean, that's a very, very interesting development. And certainly if the CEO, Anthony Kalanick, had actually told or actually did tell Lewandowski not to bring the information with him and took steps to avoid it from infecting the Uber technology and Uber database, then that would be a very positive thing from Uber. But again, I think it's a very much of a factual question as to what steps he actually did take to communicate that opinion. Was it, you know, don't bring that information with you, wink, wink, nod, we're gonna look the other way. Right. And I've been involved with some cases like that where basically they knew about it, but they took the ostrich approach and stuck their heads in the sand after that and were very surprised, so to speak, when they found out that their new hires had been using the information that they were told not to use. So it's hard to say at that point, really, what it does. It can be very favorable for Uber, and it could probably get them off the hook for corporate liability, or it suggests that if they knew about it and didn't take adequate steps, in fact, to really prevent it from using it, it could really create a lot of trouble. So again, it's something that we'll have to watch very carefully and see how it plays out.
Do you see anything, any sort of strategic wrinkles to the fact that neither Anthony Lewandowski, the engineer, nor Travis Kalanick, the CEO, are any longer with Uber, and yet they are key witnesses in this case?
I think in general, it's good to have, when you're in a situation like this, it's good to have your witnesses working for the company rather than being outside the company. And I won't finish the rest of the analogy is about that. But it's good to have them working for the company, and the fact that they have taken steps now to cut off contact and cut off their employment with the company, to me, suggests that Uber is working closely with the U.S. Attorney's Office as conducting an internal investigation, and probably has thrown themselves to the feet of the U.S. Attorney's Office and say, we will do whatever it takes to avoid having criminal penalties brought against the company. We're cooperating fully with your investigation. We've gotten rid of the people who are creating the problems. We've thrown them to the wolf, so to speak, and we're going to clean up the act. And I've worked on a number of cases under similar circumstances where you basically fire all the employees and you take that approach, and it has been successful from preventing the company from being indicted criminally, but it ended up having to pay a large civil fine. So it may prevent, by taking this action, does suggest that they are cooperating with the U.S. Attorney's Office and are taking actions to avoid being prosecuted criminally.
Right. So in addition to needing a new CEO and a new engineer in charge of LIDAR-related technology, whatever Anthony Lewandowski was at the company, Uber's senior management suite is looking a little vacant these days, at least as of June 15th. There's a good piece at Seeking Alpha that was dated that day that talks about the various roles that Uber is currently needing to fill. In addition to those two, its chief operating officer, its chief financial officer, its general counsel, and its marketing chief are all vacant as well. I don't know that has legal ramifications, except for it would be nice to have a general counsel in place while you are pursuing litigation like this. I don't know. Matt, any friends you think are going to toss their hat in the ring?
I would advise all of my friends from staying away from the situation. my question for Peter is, it seems like that while Mr. Landowski was working for Google, he was also – like they knew that he was engaged in trade secret violations. He was running a separate company that was essentially selling services to Google itself. Is there any is there any legal implication for Waymo or for Google that there's at least a plausible argument that they knew that this was happening while he was working for them?
I don't think so. I think I don't think it would really affect the ongoing issues in this particular case, but I'm sure Uber will do their best to use it to smear Mr. Lewandowski as a bad guy and create a perception that he is a bad guy and we shouldn't be responsible for the acts of a bad actor. I think they have to be careful with how far they go in this particular area, because I think if they go too far and they did know about what Lewandowski was doing while employed at Google, then the obvious response would be, well, if you knew this guy was such a bad guy, why did you go ahead and hire him? If you knew he was capable of doing the kinds of things he had done at Google, why did you hire him and not take adequate precautions at Uber? So I think it is a possibility that it may become an issue, but I think it's something that both parties are going to have to tread very carefully on.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a fascinating case, and definitely, you know, Uber is a company that I think will survive what it's going through right now in the event it survives this lawsuit. It's one that I think has a lot of impact on where the company can go in the future. So we'll continue to keep our eyes on it and let you know what's going on there. Let's move on now. And we've been talking about some criminal-related issues, as in the criminal prosecution of claims related to trade secrets. But Peter has done a lot of work and study over the years on the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which turned 30 last year. So we wanted to check in on it and see how it's doing.
That's a difficult question. I don't think anybody lit any candles on the CFAA's 30th birthday. Put it that way. It's probably a bigger mess today than it's ever been. I mean, when you think back that the Computer Crime Act, as we said, is now 31 years old, which means that it was originally enacted by Congress way back in 1986. There have been a number of amendments to it over the years, but in many events, it's substantially the same law that it was back in 1986, or certainly the same law that it's been for the last 15 or 20 years, and it certainly hasn't kept up with the changes in the internet. I mean, back in 1986, there was no World Wide Web. I mean, Ronald Reagan was president. It was just an entirely different world than it is today, and I think that the law has to be updated to better reflect the times. And right now, the big issue is what exactly does it mean to access a computer without authorization or in excess of authorization? And those are the two terms of art, the key words under the CFAA, that it basically makes it illegal to access a computer without authorization or in excess of authorization. And what those terms mean are not very well defined, and courts have taken very different approaches to what those terms mean. What is a violation of it? And it's very unclear that do those is accessing a computer in violations of her terms of use contract, for example? Is that accessing a computer without authorization or in excess of authorization? So this has led to a great deal of uncertainty in this particular area. And really, I think we can do a lot better, and Congress really should focus on updating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to bring it into the 21st century, because it's really not there at all right now.
Right. And don't we have a circuit split right now in what constitutes exceeding authorized access?
Yes, we do. There's the broad approach, and then there's the so-called narrow approach. The broad approach could basically turn on terms of use and other things that exceeds authorized access, whereas there's a narrow approach that really limits it in general terms. And in particular, the Ninth, Second, and I believe the Fourth Circuit have taken a narrow approach. The 11th and the Fifth Circuit have taken a very different approach, a much broader approach to it. So there clearly is a circuit split, but so far, the Supreme Court has not shown an inclination to, even with a circuit split, the Supreme Court has not shown an inclination to accept cert in the case. Excuse me. And in fact, they've denied cert in at least one case, and probably two cases, I believe, involving this very question. But there is a case right now that is up on cert, that they filed for cert in the Supreme Court out of California, out of the Ninth Circuit. So we'll see if the Supreme Court accepts cert in that particular case to at least clarify some specific issues related to this area. But even if the Supreme Court does go ahead and clarify this particular issue, I think it's high time. Again, I emphasize that that's only one of the issues involved, one of the problems with the CFAA. So it's really time for Congress to go ahead and completely amend the act to reflect what the state of technology is in 2017.
Let's talk about, is it the Vall case, V-A-L-L-E? What's the party's name?
No, the case that's up on cert, the Vall case, is an interesting case that was a Second Circuit case out of the Southern District of New York, involving a policeman for the New York Police Department. And the facts are kind of gruesome or silly, depending on how you view them. Who basically sent emails about eating, how to cook and eat his girlfriend, and he was prosecuted for using his police department computer in excess of authority, because obviously to use it and send emails like that were not authorized. And in fact, in that particular case, the Second Circuit struck down his conviction under the CFAA, because they found that he was authorized the way he used it. There was no explicit statement that he wasn't allowed to authorize it and use it in that particular case. The case you're speaking of that's up on cert, I believe, is United States versus Nozzle, which is a Ninth Circuit case involving a employee or executive at the search group Korn Ferry that basically accessed the Korn Ferry database and took it with him to start his own search employee search company, and he was convicted in the Northern District of California. The Ninth Circuit upheld his conviction, and I believe that's the case that's now up on appeal or up on cert to the United States Supreme Court.
Right. So the Valle case, his name is Gilberto, V-A-L-L-E, so I'm guessing it's Valle.
Yeah.
That one, the Supremes have not taken a stab at, correct?
They have not. I don't know if it's up on cert, but it certainly hasn't been granted in that case. It may be up there with the Ninth Circuit. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I wanted to sort of probe some of the differences between some of these cases. In that one, the argument on Valle's behalf was that it couldn't have been without authorization, because he actually, in his role as an officer and using his own account, was able to access everything that he accessed. It was just that he then put that material to a purpose that had nothing to do with his job. But he didn't use anybody else's account or password. He didn't, you know, jump onto an account by hacking. He actually used his own scope of professional tools, but he used them for a purpose that he was not authorized to use them for. And that saved him in the second circuit. But in some of these other cases, we have slightly different wrinkles, right? In the, let's see, is it the Nozzle case that you just brought up, where the candidates lists, as you said, were, I suppose, brought with the person after they left the job? Is that how it teed up? Without authorization.
Yes, that,
is that right?
That's the basic distinction in the Nozzle case. The second one you mentioned, that the employee list from Korn Ferry apparently was obtained after the Korn Ferry employees had left the employment of Korn Ferry. So that's the distinction there. And clearly, since they had left, they were no longer had the authorization and acted either in excess of authorization, or probably in that particular case was held to have acted without authorization. But the problem is, in these cases, is, you know, we're splitting hairs as to what exactly it means to act without authorization or in excess of authorization. Is there a cease and desist letter? If you send a cease and desist letter to somebody, does that create then, and then they access a computer, does that mean they're accessing it in excess of authorization? How many cease and desist letters do they have to send? I mean, just a whole bunch of factors are involved. And since the CFAA is a criminal law, it's really incumbent upon courts to define the law very strictly, so people know and are put on notice as to what they're doing is a violation of the law. And I think they're just right now, you don't know whether, I mean, many people, I mean, they're obvious if you hack into a computer, there's no question, you know, under the common definition of hacking, there's no question that you violate the CFAA. But that's not the situation that arises in many cases. And in those cases, it's less clear, and the defendant may or may not know whether what they're doing is a crime. And that came up, unfortunately, in the case most clearly of Aaron Swartz, who, as we all know, committed suicide a couple of years ago after being indicted by the federal government, by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Massachusetts, for computer fraud violations based on accessing a database at Harvard and MIT. So again, you know, is that something that should be prosecuted criminally? If it should be prosecuted criminally, people should know that it's a violation. And I think there is a very strong argument, putting aside whether it should or should not be a violation, that he may not have known that it was a violation. So I think that's the type of issue where we really run into problems.
Right. And if you could remind people who haven't been following along with our show for the years we've been covering the CFAA and Aaron Swartz, what the potential fines and penalties are for violating the CFAA.
Well, again, the potential penalties are based in general on the amount of damage or information, the value of the information obtained, the damage to the system. But potentially, Aaron Swartz was looking at a number of years, a number of months. I mean, it could have been 3 to 5 years or more in prison for something that he may have believed, and in good faith believed, that was not a crime. And certainly there are people a lot smarter than me who've argued that what he did was not a crime.
What's your take as a former prosecutor on how prosecutors view this tool in their arsenal these days? Do you feel like it's being over applied or more broadly applied than it should be?
From what I've seen in most cases, it's being pretty fairly applied. But the argument, even if that's true, and even we assume we take that as a truth, that shouldn't give people a great deal of comfort, because I don't want, and I don't think most people would want, a prosecutor to have as much discretion to decide and whether to take a case or not. I mean, certainly there are limits on what they can do, but when you give a prosecutor, a prosecutor's office, the U.S. Attorney's office, so much discretion in whether or not to bring a particular charge, it should be, there should be more curbs on it, and should be much clearer than just left to prosecutorial discretion. I think most prosecutors are at the federal level do want to do the right thing, and are not going to abuse the law. At least that's what I would hope, and that's was my experience as a prosecutor for 8 years. But everybody may not share that view, and it is a law that unfortunately is susceptible to abuse. So how many times does it have to be abused before people realize that it's not a good law?
So we could get this Nosal case up in front of the Supreme Court. Do you see any momentum in Congress to actually amend the law so that it's more clear and update it 31 years down the road now?
Well, I live in Washington, D.C., so do I see the Congress doing anything? it might be a better question, but I have, in all honesty, they have not really taken the lead in any area of technology and computer and the laws like the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, the Stored Communication Act for wiretapping. You know, they're it's a good topic for next shows on wiretapping and cell phones and things like that. But they certainly have shown no initiative or inclination to get involved in these sorts of areas at all. And so I don't have a great deal of optimism that they're going to really do something. They haven't done anything in there. Have been, I think the last amendment, substantive amendment to the computer crime statute was way back in 2002, maybe a little later, but they haven't done anything substantively in 10 or 15 years.
Oh, that's depressing. Matt, anything to add to our discussion of the CFAA here?
No, I'm taking notes from Peter, so I'm going to let him handle this one.
Right. Something else we wanted to take notes from you about, Peter, has to do with stealing rice or things like rice. There's a fascinating piece that you've been featured in called Spies in the Field as Farming Goes High-Tech Espionage Threat Grows,
right.
Talks about intellectual property theft and China primarily. And you might, when you think of this, you might think of being able to pick up movie DVDs for a dollar on the street in China, but it goes way farther than that. And recently, it went on a flight from Hawaii to China, where a group of scientists returning home were stopped and found to have rice seeds in their luggage. How is that problematic, and what happened there?
Well, when you think about it, it's really, in some ways, it's really not that surprising. The kind of rice was a bioengineered rice that was capable of, you know, not needing as much fertilizer or better, that it wasn't susceptible to pesticides, or it had its own, and to bugs and things like that. And it taken, I believe in this case, I don't remember who the victim company was, but companies spend a great deal of money engineering better food stock, better wheat, better grain, things like that. And obviously China as the largest company in the largest country in the world, has a great deal of incentive, in a sense, to be able to get better food technology, to be able to feed their $1.6 billion people. And trade secrets can involve anything. I mean, most people think of trade secrets as technology or high technology of stealing something, but really it can be technology related to anything. So it's really not so surprising that there would be efforts made to steal this kind of technology. Another interesting factor about this case is it does highlight that many of the theft of trade secret cases, the criminal theft of trade secret cases that have been brought by the government under the Economic Espionage Act, which we've been referring to earlier, a large number of those cases have involved Chinese companies or some relationship between the defendants and China. And there's been a great deal of consternation now among certain people in the Chinese American community that they feel that they're being singled out for prosecutions of these type of cases, because approximately half or more than half of the cases in this particular area in the last 5 years have involved either Chinese citizens or allegations that the trade secrets were going back to China to benefit Chinese companies, things like that. So the answer that the FBI and the other U.S. attorney's offices have been given is that they're not focusing on Chinese defendants per se, but Chinese defendants are more active in stealing American trade secrets rather than we're focusing on prosecuting Chinese. And as the truth may be, it's probably somewhere between the two. But there has been a lot of issues that have been raised about the large number of Chinese defendants in these Economic Espionage Act cases.
Ventria Bioscience out of Junction City, Kansas, was the company that developed the rice or the gene sliced rice here. Really, really interesting area of the law, area of law enforcement. I'm fascinated that I don't know, you know, as you're scanning luggage to travel, what agency is in charge of that, the FDA in looking for things like this? I just don't know. But I'm sort of surprised that they're able to find rice seeds in luggage about to go overseas. It's pretty amazing that they were even able to suss that out. So, fascinating all around. And if you'd like to read more about it or about anything we've been discussing today, we do make our topic lists available in a couple of public forums. First, you can follow our Flipboard magazine. If you find me on Flipboard, I'm Dee Howell there. I maintain a This Week in Law magazine that we put all our stories into. Or if you just want the list episode by episode, if you go to tagpacker.com/user/This Week in Law, we're on episode 391. This week, and all our links are there as well. So we hope you'll check them out and enjoy. And in a moment here, we're going to talk about some social media free speech ramification cases, both of which are really kind of quirky and interesting. So I'm excited to get into them. Before we get there, though, we're going to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Betterment, the largest independent online financial advisor. Betterment is designed to help improve customers' long-term returns and lower taxes for retirement planning, building wealth, and other financial goals. Betterment takes advanced investment strategies and uses technology to deliver them to more than 250,000 customers. Based on the information you share, Betterment will make tailored recommendations on decisions like how much to invest, how much risk to take on in your portfolio, and the type of investment account you should have. On average, Betterment's tax-coordinated portfolio can increase portfolio value by an estimated 15% over 30 years. Betterment gives you a clear view of your net worth when you sync your outside accounts, such as bank accounts and other investments. Another reason to choose Betterment: low, transparent advisory fees compared to traditional services. Only 0.25% on assets under management, with an option to upgrade to 0.4% or 0.5% for access to a certified financial planner or licensed financial expert. Betterment cares about keeping your money and data secure, which is why they have advanced data encryption and login protection. If you want to talk to someone about your specific financial situation, you can access their team of licensed financial experts. Investing involves risk. For a limited time, you can get up to 6 months managed for free. For more information, visit betterment.com/twill. That's betterment.com/twill. Betterment, rethink what your money can do. Hey, Matt, before we move on, did you have any questions about spliced rice that you wanted to ask?
I would like to find out how they found that. I've been searched before. Yeah. I don't think they were looking for rice. And the other thing is that this just provides like an interesting set of facts where in order to protect IP, like on a computer system or doing software, you're able to do encryption, you're able to do all different sorts of things. But when your IP is grown out in the world, you just don't have those kinds of protections. So it's interesting to see how the law almost has to step in a little bit more in those situations if that's going to be adequately protected.
I just, as an aside, I think that often, especially in these trade secret cases, many of the defendants are actually caught and fall into kind of the stupid criminal category. that it's been my experience that if the FBI or whomever starts asking questions, for example, at an airport or wherever, and it's amazing how much information that people volunteer and get themselves into trouble.
Yes, and I am assuming, as you point out, Matt, that this was DRM free rice, that the secrets within it could be unlocked without having to break any encryption technology. Okay, let's move on to some stories about the social web. And we've moved on to somebody else whose last name is going to be challenging for me because I don't know if it's Tiffany Dehen or Tiffany Dehen, but we will soldier on nevertheless. Tiffany is a recent graduate, I believe just within the last couple of months, of the University of San Diego Law School down the road here in Southern California. And we haven't talked about her on the show yet, but she has been making a splash in the legal arena since about February of this year when she filed a lawsuit against the University of San Diego Law School, School of Law, and also against Twitter and against some people who were harassing her at school per her allegations. And as part of that harassment, set up a Twitter account that purported to be her and labeled itself a parody account. At the time, way back in February, she filed a complaint pro se. She did not have legal counsel. And snarkily enough, the lawyers of the world who had drafted many a complaint in their lives, presumably Ms. Dehen had not, took one look at what she filed and said, oh my gosh, before you start filing lawsuits like this, you better learn how to draft a complaint, prompting many sort of rabbit hole discussions about what people are actually learning in law school these days and how a law school a graduate could have emerged and initiated a lawsuit in this way, which was not the way that most lawyers would do so. It was rambling and disjointed and called itself a brief rather than a complaint and did not really seem to know what it was doing. Ms. Dehen has now gotten counsel and filed. She did, at the time she filed her complaint, have the presence of mind and civil procedure to advise the court that a First Amended complaint would be filed when she was able to do so. And now she has counsel and she has done so. So she has something more conventionally pending before the court. And coincidentally, seems to have a bit more substance to what she's saying. I think most people who've been looking at this case over the year or so or writing about the case for that time that it's been pending, it hasn't been pending a year, half a year, have said, parody account, get over it. California has an anti-SLAPP statute, strategic lawsuits against public participation. This isn't going to go anywhere. Well, we don't really know where it's going to go or where it's not going to go yet, because no one has responded to the first amended complaint just yet. Twitter has counsel. The University of San Diego has counsel. I don't know about the individual Doe defendants she is also trying to pursue. But the fact is that this lawsuit could become an interesting exploration into what is a parody account and what is qualified for free speech as such, and under Twitter's guidelines. And again, we can get into, you know, what is free speech and why are we even discussing free speech when we're talking about Twitter? Because they're a private entity, not a government entity, and they can set whatever guidelines they'd like. But parody does have a free speech impacting definition. And just like we've been discussing with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, if there is uncertainty about what is and is not a thing, you might find that something gets swept up, in this case being called a parody, when really it's maybe exceeded those boundaries. Here, Miss Tiffany Dahan was, done some the numbers that were done on her in this Twitter account were pretty bad. She was called a Nazi and a member of the KKK, and she jokes were made about how she likes to harm animals. So, it's not just that someone was imitating her style and exaggerating and attempting to derive humor just from her personality, but it possibly rose to the level of defamation in that it, you know, was purporting to be her and purporting to tar her with a bunch of pretty unsavory stuff. So I think it'll be an interesting case to watch, particularly because the parties are going to take it seriously and respond, and we'll see what happens from there. I do think the legal argument about what should be able to qualify as a parody Twitter account has some interest. And also the other really interesting part of the case is her basis for suing the university, which has various conduct rules that whereby it promises to protect students against harassment, or sets forth that it may take steps to protect students from harassment. And she's relying on that code of conduct as basically having been promises that were made to her and not kept by the university. So will be interesting to see where this case goes, and we've been remiss in not bringing it up on the show until now. Matt, have you been following this throughout the year?
Thankfully, I've not been following this throughout the year, but I was interested in the First Amendment protection. I guess I wasn't aware that parody was a specific carve out. I just thought that the First Amendment was much broader than that, and I thought that parody related to copyright violations, and it was an exemption. I thought that what the First Amendment protected was everything short of almost fighting words was the claim. So I think that if that's up to fighting words, then the question is whether these are fighting words and not whether it's a parody. But I defer to both of you for greater knowledge on that.
No, I think you're right that you're making that distinction. And I do think that there would be a distinction between what's permitted under First Amendment law and what's permitted under copyright law, and then how this all interrelates to what's a permissible impersonation account under a permissible parody account versus an impermissible, I guess, impersonation account under Twitter's guidelines. And of course, that's all impacted too by the fact that we have a statute in California. I'm not sure how many other states have gotten behind this, where you cannot have an account where you're holding yourself out in a serious way a non-parody kind of way as another individual. So I think that's where the parody speech interplay comes in. Whether you have identified yourself as, you know, I am poking fun here and therefore this is not going to get me in trouble as an impersonator, which it would otherwise in California. Any thoughts on this, Peter?
Yeah, I think it also, the parody also plays into whether or not she's been defamed or not. And to the extent it's a parody, then there could not be any defamation. But if there is a parody aspect to it, that everybody would know that it's what they're saying is just a parody. It's not true. So therefore she wouldn't be defamed. I think that's the most important part of one of the issues related to parody here.
Right. So it's an interesting case, and we will keep an eye on it and let you know what happens in response to the First Amendment amended complaint that's been filed. Also, another really interesting case, and one with, again, pretty broad ramifications should any other court decide to go this way. But over in Switzerland, there was a gentleman who has been held liable for defamation for having liked a comment on Facebook that he did not make. The comment apparently was accusing another party. There was some sort of controversy involving animal welfare folks and vegans and a protest. And there was a person involved in that controversy who had made racist comments and had some sort of prior conviction as well. And the party who got fined here disliked that person and agreed that he had been racist and out of line and therefore liked some comments to that effect. And found himself on the wrong end of a defamation claim. And the court said that by clicking the like button, the defendant clearly endorsed the unseemly content and made it his own, the court's statement said. The judge ruled that the defendant had failed to prove that the comments he had liked on Facebook were true. At the same time, by liking the comments, the man had disseminated them to his list of Facebook contacts and thus made them accessible to a large number of people. So this seems like a really, really tenuous basis for a defamation determination. And the lawyer for the party who was fined here, he was fined over $4,000 US, about $4,100 US. He desperately wants the courts to clarify whether hitting a like button on social media should be given the same weight as other forms of speech more commonly cited in defamation cases. The lawyer went on to say, if the courts want to prosecute people for likes on Facebook, we could easily need to triple the number of judges in this country. They could also obviously easily become an assault on the freedom of expression. So fascinating case. I have a hard time with it. Obviously, I think that simply liking something that someone else has said is problematic as a basis for a defamation claim, but I can almost see how the court cobbled this together in its mind, much as I can almost see how a court might struggle with the cues that are being offered when emojis are offered up for interpretation. We've talked about that much on the show lately, that the Facebook like maybe falls into that same kind of category. Here the court said the defendant clearly endorsed the unseemly content and made it his own. Is that what a like means? This court thought so. What do you think, Matt?
I think that thankfully in the United States, we would not get into that question. There's a case that came out last week. It was Packingham versus North Carolina, in which North Carolina had a law that prohibited all sex offenders from going onto social media that was a loosely defined term, but under the First Amendment, Justice Kennedy and the four liberal justices said that it was inherent to the dignity of being a person that you can be on social media. So I can't imagine that they would say that in that situation, and also hold that that liking something, even bad speech or even racist speech or, you know, terrible speech, would be criminalized. So I don't think we have to go down that road, but I thought it was funny that they said that they'd have to hire three times as many judges.
Yeah, I hope you're right. I don't know that I see it, you know, as quite as clear cut that courts would be, oh, yes, of course, if we're going to let if being on social media is a fundamental human right, that it necessarily follows that you can like anything that you want and not have it somehow become an endorsement or a statement. I think those are apples and oranges, maybe, but I do think it's fascinating. Peter, want to weigh in?
Yeah, I am. I've been thinking about this, and I'm going to take a little bit of a contrary position to this, to the extent mm-hmm. if it involves defamatory speech, because it's different from the case that you like if you like hate speech or attack on somebody like that. And certainly there's a First Amendment for protection for that kind of speech, but there is no First Amendment protection for defamatory speech. And if you're liking defamatory mm-hmm. speech, it involves a republication of the defamatory speech to, as the court in this particular case pointed out, that it was being circulated among his friends that were on his list, that he got all the likes on, that all his friends saw the defamatory speech. So there is a certain aspect here of republication that to me suggests that under certain circumstances where it's widely disseminated, I'm not so sure that the issue here isn't as clear cut as has been suggested. So I'm kind of in the minority on that position.
Wouldn't you need to prove that the individual knowingly know that the information was false, and also that they did it with malice in order to do that? Or would it change because it's a private individual?
If it's a private individual, there's no malice involved, but they would have to have some knowledge about the intent and knowledge of the truth and veracity of the statement. So I was assuming that part of the defamatory, if the person broadly knows that it's a defamatory statement and goes ahead and recirculates it, republishes it, I think there's a possibility that even a court in the United States under similar circumstances would find that as defamation. That's just, I think there are a lot of factors that would go in 99% of the cases involving somebody hitting a like button on Facebook. The court would come to the conclusion that that's not defamation. But I think, again, maybe I'm thinking about the one in a millionth possibility, but I think there's a possibility that under a unusual set of facts, there may be defamation.
Yeah, I think I'm with you, Peter. And I come down to there are just a couple of complicating factors that technology is injecting here that make it hard for courts to do this kind of analysis. And that's why I do think that you could find it. I think this ruling is looked at as kind of an outrageous outlier. But maybe it's not, based on the fact that I think courts might have a hard time deciding, you know, what does a like really mean? What are you doing when you do that? Are you speaking? Are you endorsing? Are you, fill in the blank? There was something else. Second point fled my brain. If it comes back to me, I'll let you know. I know. Actually, there are three points here, because of course, defamation involves, spreading the defamatory comment, and whether you've liked something. I you were starting to touch on that, Peter. You know what that means. What mechanism is triggered from the distribution standpoint when you hit like, you know, how do you know, or do you even know who's going to see that you have liked that? Mm-hmm. And then finally, you injected, Matt, the really interesting aspect of whether you'd have to show malice or not. And that all goes to whether someone is a public figure or not. If the person allegedly defamed bringing the claim is a public figure, then you do have to show that. And if they're not, then you don't. And I have thought it was fascinating for ever since I started publishing a blog in the early 2000s that figuring out who's a public figure these days is nigh impossible, because many, many more people have a presence online or otherwise that makes them in one way or another, not strictly speaking, a completely private citizen. They have some sort of public or social persona that I think courts haven't by any means decided how that impacts whether you're a public figure or not for purposes of that malice standard. So fascinating witch's brew of issues brought up by that case in Zurich. And I think it's going to give us our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, which is going to be like at your own risk. We put these phrases in our show in case you are watching or listening for continuing legal or other professional education in your jurisdiction. If you are a lawyer in the United States, we have a handy dandy chart for you of how you might go about submitting for credit in your area. If you go to wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page there, and there will be more information there for you. Let's see, where were we going to move after the social web? We were going to stay on these topics of free speech and the CFAA, and we were going to go ahead and jump in with our a story that relates to the First Amendment and play the official bumper for that one. So we have found a way now to tie together free speech and the CFAA and the DMCA, and it's all in this case involving something called HiQ that scrapes the public profiles of LinkedIn users. Tell us about this, Peter.
Well, apparently this is a lawsuit that was recently filed in the Northern District of California, and HiQ has been scraping the data profile, as you said, of LinkedIn users. And LinkedIn then, because it's public, LinkedIn then sent a cease and desist letter to HiQ, putting them on notice that any further scraping and accessing the LinkedIn computers is without authorization or in excess of authorization, as we were discussing earlier, and therefore would be in violation of the computer, the CFAA, DMCA, some California state statutes. And HiQ has basically alleged and come back with, well, this is public information. This is data belonging to that public, that the public puts on. It relates to public information. And in addition, LinkedIn allows other companies to access the information, so they have a First Amendment right to access this particular information. So it basically puts the First Amendment, the right to access public information, directly against some statutes that may prevent public information from being used in a particular way. So it really kind of brings together a lot of what we've been discussing and a lot of very important issues that come up in social media time and time again these days, in which the law really has no simple answers for, and makes what I actually enjoy practicing law is thinking about problems like this and trying to help companies solve these problems. But it's a really very interesting situation.
Yeah, it is. And I'm happy to see that in addition to raising issues under the CFAA and the DMCA, that trespass to chattels has raised its head here, too. We have a couple of cases in California where that has been pivotal. They're quite old now, but that doesn't mean that it might not apply in this case. And it may be that the reason they're old is I think it's getting harder and harder to prove trespass to chattels under the standard that the California Supreme Court enacted, which I think requires a showing of, you know, a pretty high level of damage or impact to the servers that you're taking the data from. And that as technology has improved, that's probably harder and harder to show. Matt, anything you want to weigh in on here?
No, I'm generally glad that the trespass to chattels is brought back up because that's just fun. But the I think a possible I wonder if the first sale doctrine will be brought up in terms of if you're a user of a social network of some sort like LinkedIn, you're being sold advertising of some sort, and therefore is there a quid pro quo of the information on there, and therefore you're able to use it. I don't know if it would work, but I think it'd be an interesting way to approach it.
Right. It seems like something that HiQ could have done here, but it doesn't look like they took this route. I haven't read the complaint, so I'm not clear on all the alleged facts by any means. But, the data that is locked inside companies like LinkedIn or Twitter, Facebook, others, is quite valuable, and there are lots of people who want to get at it and use it for their own purposes. And scraping seems like probably the least desirable business way to go about getting that data. That if you were able to make an API call, it would certainly be more advantageous, less work, etc. And presumably you'd be able to have an arrangement where you were doing that in an authorized way. So to decide you're going to scrape, I think, is a pretty bold move in today's day and age. Of course, then if you follow my premise further, the fact that LinkedIn and these various other companies may be licensing your data out for purposes that you may not have thought about or authorized becomes problematic as well. Any more thoughts about this, Peter?
Yeah, I would, Denise. On the last point, to me, the last point you made is perhaps the most important, and it's something that I've been advocating mm-hmm. in this area. Is this the data that LinkedIn has about the users? I really believe that it should belong to the individual users. And they should have a greater say in how that data is being used by LinkedIn and by all the other online services that use such data. And that if they want to use it, that users are entitled to some form of compensation for it, and simply mm-hmm. do not give up any rights in it. It's information about a person, their likes, their dislikes, their consumer preferences, whatever. And I think that information belongs, as is any other kind of intangible property, really belongs to the owner. And in this case, the owner is the individual, not my belief, not LinkedIn. And I think, you know, that perhaps this mm-hmm. train has left the station, and this is just the way now things are approached. But I am very troubled, continue to be troubled by the fact that data in this case is considered to be owned by LinkedIn and not by the users themselves.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I hope that LinkedIn is considering making that argument in this case, that, you know, it's this data that you're calling publicly available isn't really that in the way that we're used to thinking about that, that it is proprietary data to our users, and we have a responsibility to, and we have, you know, represented to our users that we will keep it as such. So Matt, you were going to say something?
I just, you know, that may be going back to Peter's point about the property rights in your data, may go back to the fact that we haven't seen legislation in, you know, 31 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Yes. Yep. Okay. Yeah, that's a really interesting one to watch. Peter, thank you for bringing it up for us today. Let us move on and talk about what you're able to do. We're talking about things 31 years old. How about things at 31,000 feet? Let's talk about air travel and regulations that impact it. So we've brought this up on the show before. We have a little bit of clarification on the issue now. And the issue is that up until recently, you were not allowed to make calls, cellular calls, while up in the air. And part of the justification for that was so that cell signals wouldn't interfere with avionics. And that's why you're always asked to put your phone in airplane mode, et cetera. And more recently, only use the in-flight Wi-Fi for your connectivity. Well, one thing that people have been discovering either by accident or on purpose is that when you're on the in-flight Wi-Fi more and more, you can actually make and receive calls. So, and I think that the way it came up for me was, you know, having logged onto the Wi-Fi and not really understanding that I had Wi-Fi calling turned on my phone, or the fact that I, you know, even knowing that I did, that that was going to mean that I would get a call on an airplane in flight. That took me by surprise. It took my seatmates by surprise too. And I quickly silenced it and, you know, didn't take the call, told the person, call you back, I'm on a plane. But I guess there are people that actually will pick up those Wi-Fi calls and have conversations. And that has disturbed our FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, who now has issued a statement about this. It looks as an order from the FCC, and it looks as though the FCC is going to prevent you from using the available Wi-Fi or any other connectivity. I guess people are actually in reading up about this to talk about it today. I guess there are entrepreneurial folks out there who are trying to figure out a way to get you cell service up there while you're in flight. Drones are mentioned, various communication satellites are mentioned to make cell service available in the air where otherwise you would just lose signal. So even though that might be available at some point, even though Wi-Fi calling is available now, at least in the US, it looks like the FCC is going to say, no, we're not going to have that happen. And in fact, Ajit Pai, I will try and pull up and read you the quote. Part of his justification is just, a moment of silence during air travel, that he feels that he and other travelers make that an important priority, so that even if this safety issue, avionics interference issue is taken out of play, the FCC still feels like it's their place in the world to give you that moment of silence mid-air. Any thoughts about this, Peter?
I guess my thought about this is, I guess the FCC is not taking any actions about the screaming babies in row C, row 3C, to reduce the moment of silence on the plane. I think, you know, from what I can tell, the argument that it's going to interfere from the avionics, I'm not a technical expert, doesn't appear to be real, because, I mean, how many times have you left your phone on non-airplane mode when you're on a plane? And I'm sure half the customers on the plane have done the same thing unintentionally. So I can't imagine that's a real problem, since we don't see a lot of planes dropping out of the sky. But I guess not having phone connectivity on planes is probably a good thing. There is a nice to be able to be in a space where you're not connected that closely. You can say to your client that you're about to get on a 6-hour flight to California, and you'll call them when they get there and not 15 minutes after you take off. So I guess it's a nice thing.
Yeah, I don't know that I am on board with the FCC deciding that, you know, it should regulate phone calls and not screaming babies, you know. it seems like a an odd, the fact that Ajit Pai wants a moment of silence at 31,000 feet it seems like an odd basis for this rulemaking, but okay. The other thing I found interesting in looking at this, just sort of one of those did you know things, there is no Wi-Fi on flights in India, or there has not been, but they're going to go ahead and allow it finally now. The security agencies in India have previously prevented Wi-Fi from being on aircraft, worried about security risks, jeopardizing flight safety, interfering with communication between the aircraft and crew, et cetera, et cetera. So even if you're on a flight where, you know, you had Wi-Fi coming across some other part of the world, when you travel over and into India, it has had to be blocked out until now. And now it looks like they're going to change that rule and give you Wi-Fi on your flights in India. So just one of those interesting bits of information. And then another interesting bit of information that the FCC hasn't done anything about yet, but may. There is a proposal before the FCC to allow folks who you might put yourself on the do not call list to guard against. If you're on the do not call list, I assume they would not be able to do this without triggering the various penalties and restrictions of the do not call list. But assuming they're able to reach out to you, rather than just call you while your phone is active and either bother you when you pick up or leave you a voicemail when you pick up, they are working on a proposal that would allow them to go straight to your voicemail. In other words, to fill up your voicemail, your cellular voicemail, and I assume also perhaps, I don't know how it would work technically, if they could do this with landlines as well, but to go directly to your voicemail box, however, wherever, and basically leave you spam there. This is something that the GOP has filed a comment in support of, apparently wanting to send you campaign messages that way. But it's a more broader proposal that would apply not just to political messages, but to private commercial messages as well. Matt, did you have some thoughts on this?
Yeah, I don't understand why they're spending political capital on this. It just seems like no one's going to like getting this, and I can't imagine it convincing anyone to vote for someone or go out and vote for somebody. So I guess I don't have like a real strong principled approach to like why not to do it, but I would personally sign up for the first app that automatically deleted these if it came about that these came in. On the flight thing, though, you know, for Republicans who are continually talking about government doesn't need to be involved in this, you know, the private companies can handle this. They can say you can't be on flights on our plane, and if they wanted to make a little room where you could have flights where there wasn't a sound, that seems like a good innovation that the Republicans should be advocating for. I also would find it really interesting if this applied to private planes, if you know your executives can't get on the phone while they're flying around the country. So I don't think they did a very good job this week.
No, it does not, and neither did the prior rule. Where the justification for not having cellular calls was that it might interfere with avionics. That only applies to commercial air travel. Your private pilot or private charter. Yes?
I just have one question is whether the spam rule that you're talking about applies to phones that are on planes.
There you go. Maybe Ajit Pai will think that his moment of tranquility should protect us all from spam as well. In any event, if you are motivated about this issue, about not getting unsolicited messages direct to your voicemail, the FCC began taking public comments recently. So you can go ahead and let them know what you think about all that. And as we close in on the end of the show here, we have an entertainment related story that I wanted to get to. Really interesting. Listener Ken H sent this my way. I would not have seen it otherwise. It is a video where the gentleman in question, we'll see his name in a minute. His last name is Hung. I do remember that. He is a musician, I assume. If he's not a musician, he at least is very interested in music and in manipulating digital, manipulating music digitally. Let's put it that way. And he has decided that it's interesting to take a music track and flip it or invert it. So it's not so much playing it backwards in the way that you might have thought that there would be hidden messages on a LP that you could play backwards. It's not playing it backwards. I think it's playing it upside down, if that makes sense. It will make a lot more sense, I think, when you listen to it. So I'm just going to play a bit for you here.
The flip definitely sounds different, but both have a mixture of major and minor chords, so it's not as drastic as what I'm about to show you. This is A Thousand Miles by Vanessa Carlton. Do you hear that? Those were all happy chords. This is what it sounds like inverted. I also changed the piano to a string section because it's just kind of perfect that way. Enjoy. If you like that, the full version is linked in the description. I'm also going to link a bunch of others that people made, and I want to share a few snippets of some of my favorites right now.
So, I think these are just fascinating, and I encourage you to go watch this whole video because it just shows you, you know, what an interesting world we live in. We've already been talking about how technology impacts so many other areas of the law that are settled and established. Is it a copyright violation to take copyrighted compositions and invert them in the way that this person is doing? It does strike me, and hopefully you too are coming to the conclusion as you listened to what he's doing. Andrew is his name, Andrew Hung on YouTube, if you want to look him up. What he's doing here is creating something that does not really sound like the original compositions, but is interesting because it relates to and in fact is a mirror image of the original compositions, yet, you know, to listen to, it sounds very original and unique. I wish we had Mike on today, Matt, because I'm sure he'd have a lot to say about this. We'll have to get his take at another time. What's yours?
I think it's an interesting question of law of whether, you know, under the Copyright Act, if this is a violation. I had also hoped that Mike would be here to provide us with the analysis of that.
Yeah, well, this seems like a good time to tease the fact that we will have Mike back next week. And we're all very excited. Simon Tam is going to join us next week, the frontman of the Slants, who have just won their case before the United States Supreme Court. So this will be a really good time to maybe probe that with Simon, and Mike will bring it up again next week. But just thought it was a fun thing to show folks if they hadn't seen it yet, because I certainly enjoyed watching it through when listener Ken H. sent it in. Any thoughts, Peter?
Well, I hope it's not a violation of the Copyright Act, because I certainly enjoyed it, and I love seeing somebody who takes such pleasure in what they create. But I think it's again one of those issues that there are arguments that can be made both for and against, and it's really why the law is a very interesting area. Especially the areas where it has to grapple with technological changes and how to apply existing law to things that people certainly didn't think about when they wrote the Copyright Act.
Yeah, I'm hoping that fair use would put an umbrella over this kind of a transformation of a work. But really, it's a pretty close cousin of the work, so it's hard to say. And we will run it by our more musically inclined panelists next week. In the meantime, it's going to give us our second MCLE passphrase for the show, and that is going to be turning music upside down. With that, we're going to move on to our animal selfie of the week. Our animal selfie of the week is not, in fact, an animal selfie itself. It is a tool for you to capture even more delightful animal selfies, or for your animal itself to, you know, figure out a way to capture selfies of itself and reward itself at the same time and its friends as it is taking its creative photographic works. This is a thing on Kickstarter called FlexiPaw. It is a fairly brilliant little device. I feel like we have featured something like it before. It looks familiar, but I don't think we've actually featured specifically FlexiPaw. And it clamps onto your phone and has a little articulating arm and a clip at the end. You could probably rig something like this up for yourself with enough supplies from Home Depot or Ace Hardware and a binder clip or some such thing. But the idea is you clip a treat so that it's dangling in front of the phone, ergo whichever way you have your camera facing, either at you so you can capture yourself and your darling pet, or away from you so you have your pet's full attention. It does seem to be a great way to make sure that the photographs that you're capturing of your pet don't have your pet staring off into space or wanting to run away and get distracted and do something else. So for all of those who love our animal selfie of the week and want to create more and better ones of their own, check out FlexiPaw. It costs about $16 if you pledge on Kickstarter. Matt, any thoughts?
I just think this is great. I can't wait to hear PETA's response of an inducement of stealing the photo, something like that.
That's right. These poor animals are being manipulated and photographed against their will because they're being tricked. Oh, you know, there could be some sort of breach of contract action that PETA might want to bring. If, in fact, you are dangling treats in front of your pet to get their attention, but then making off with them and not delivering on the implied promise that the treat would be forthcoming. So
it's gonna happen.
Stay tuned for FlexiPaw related animal selfie litigation, no doubt in our future. Where shall we go next? We do have a tip of the week. The tip has to do with something you might want to do to make sure that you know how Facebook is making suggestions to you, friend suggestions, you may know suggestions. We have an article that we didn't get to this week because we're running out of time, but if you are going to go to our discussion points, you'll find it there. It's from Vocative, and they're the people who do the TV series that I'm a big fan of and we've featured as a resource before called The Dark Web. And they did a piece where one of their writers anecdotally told a story about traveling to Colombia and meeting some people on a beach, but never exchanging contact information with them or even phone numbers or anything else. And finding that when they returned from their trip, Facebook was suggesting that these strangers that they had met on the beach were might be people they know and want to connect with on Facebook. So as Facebook changes its mission to be more about connecting all of us up, it does seem interesting to probe how they do all that. Facebook says that it doesn't actually track you around and suggest people locationally. In fact, I'll just read you to you from the article we didn't get to. A Facebook spokesperson said the company does not see who users text, call, or email. Therefore, the algorithm wouldn't be able to make friend suggestions based on that. Yet, if you're using email programs on your phone, such as Gmail, you are saving email addresses to your phone and Facebook will be able to see them, or they might be able to see them depending on, this is me interjecting, depending on what contact list you're using on your phone and how you save your email contacts. I personally keep those separate. Again, only if you're sharing your contacts with Facebook apps. Facebook goes on to talk about how location tracking, while it's used for advertising purposes, it is not used for friend suggestions. There was a limited small citywide test where they did otherwise last year. Otherwise, its friend recommendations are based on what it calls a variety of factors, which include mutual friends, work and education information, groups you're part of, and any digital information stored on your phone that is shared with Facebook. Other than that, Facebook deems all other connections coincidences. So if you want to limit what you're sharing from your phone with Facebook, it's pretty easy. All you have to do is go to your smartphone's settings, look for your apps section, tap on Facebook, and disable the contacts access. So that would be one way to make sure that if you're getting suggested people that you met on the beach in Colombia, it wasn't because somehow their contact information jumped onto your phone and then was communicated to Facebook. Our resources of the week are twofold. One was suggested by, they're threefold I'm seeing now. Matt, thank you for adding that. One was suggested by listener Kurt. It is another thing that you might, in addition to that dark web series, another bit of video educational edutainment that you might be interested in checking out. It goes back to 2004. It is a frontline special show called The Persuaders that focused on what was going on in the world of today's marketers and advertisers. What are the new and surprising methods they're using to decipher who we are and what we want? And where is this taking us? So I'm fascinated to watch this. I did not catch it in 2004. I think it would be really interesting to watch today and see more than 10 years later how prescient they were and what has or has not come to pass. So check out The Persuaders via listener Kurt. Also, you should check out Peter's book if you're interested in the topics, if you practice in the areas that we've been discussing today. Peter is the author of an authoritative treatise on the topics. Peter, tell us what it's called and where someone could pick it up.
Okay, it's called Intellectual Property and Computer Crimes, and it's up on the screen now, and it could be purchased online, and it's available either in an ebook or as in print. So that's my book, and it contains chapters on theft of trade secrets under the Economic Espionage Act, as well as the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and some other statutes relating to these. Chapters, these topics in general. And I would just like to add as one more plug, I am also one of the co-authors of a book that came out last year I see you don't have a link to that, called the Defend Trade Secret Act of 2016. It describes in detail some of the issues relating to the newest area of intellectual property law that Congress enacted last May, that makes for the first time gives civil protections in federal court to trade secrets. So that's another book that I've worked on, and that one is published by the publisher Wolters Kluwer.
Wonderful, wonderful. I hadn't run across that in prepping for the show, so if you email it to me, I'll make sure it gets into our discussion points for people to refer to after the fact. And definitely, if you're practicing in these areas, I think that you need to check out Peter's books on the topic. Finally, Matt rightly points out that, as promised, Mike Keyes has authored to his the TMCA blog, the blog from his firm, the Dorsey firm, a Seuss-inspired write-up of Fair Use on the Loose with the great Dr. Seuss. You know, what I think I'm going to do is just let you all go check that out on your own and enjoy it at your leisure for now, because Mike will be joining us next week. And I really do think that we have to have it read in the voice of the author when he comes back on the show. So just know that Mike keeps his promises and has written up the case that we previously discussed about the company Comic Mix and Oh, the Places You'll Boldly Go. So if you need to see it before next week, you can go head on over and read it for yourself. Otherwise, I promise you a performative reading from Mr. Keyes next week. All right. And with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap this episode of This Week in Law. We're so glad that you have been able to join us. Peter, we're so glad that you've been able to return to the show. I hope there's not quite such a long gap, but we're happy wherever, whenever, and however you can come on the show. So we're really glad to have had you back.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
And Matt, great to chat with you again too. Glad you performed some fire-defeating Ledger Domain this morning and did not get caught up on the Metro fire.
I got lucky there, but it was great to have Peter on. Learned a lot today again, as we do with all of our guests, but this was special. And Mike did deliver hours after he promised, so I just wanted to put that in there.
Good man, that Mike. Hey, have you been over to the Game of Thrones pop-up bar yet in D.C.? And Peter needs to know about this too.
That is on my list for this weekend. So, Peter, if you're interested, I think we're going to have a couple of us going over there.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. You both have to report into me if you go, and I'm so, so jealous if you do, as I'm sure all our listeners are. If you have joined us live today, you've done so at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That's when we record the show on Fridays. We're so glad that you and others can join us live. If you can, jump into IRC, play along with us live as we do the show. It's good fun. Don't worry about it, though, if you can't. If you head on over to twit.tv/twill, our whole archive of shows is there for your perusal, listening, audio or viewing video pleasure at your leisure on whatever device you prefer. So do check us out however you check us out, however we work in your life. We're just glad that we do. We're glad that you enjoy the show and send us great suggestions. This week in particular was a great week for suggestions from our listeners. So please keep them coming. You can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm D. Howell there. Matt is Law Pint there. You can reach out to us via email. Matt is mattc@twit.tv. I'm Denise @twit.tv. Mike is mike@twit.tv. Or you can find our Facebook page and leave us your thoughts there. That would be great too. However it works for you, we're just thrilled to hear what you thought about what we've discussed on the show, who you think we should invite on the show. and various things that catch your eye that have an overtone that may fit well with what we do here on This Week in Law. We love to hear about it and see it. So thanks so much for all of that and for joining us this week on This Week in Law. We'll see you next week with Simon Tam and Mike Keyes coming back too. Until then, take care.